On the diplomatic front, whenever a mission required finesse and expertise, the fleet commander sent Benfold. Operationally, when they wanted a flawless job performed post-haste, they dispatched Benfold. On the morale front, when they wanted to boost the fleet's spirits, they tried to emulate our irreverence, our belly laughs, our zany entertainments. In short, our offbeat prescription for turning hot, bored, sullen sailors into happy warriors. We wanted to protect our terrific reputation and make sure we gave no ammunition to our potential detractors. My rules for shore leave behavior in foreign ports were strict, clear, consistent, and non-negotiable. Anyone who discredited USS Benfold would be restricted to the ship for the remainder of the deployment. As I saw it, every person in the U.S. military represents the United States. We were all ambassadors, and we had to behave accordingly. I simply would not jeopardize our reputation, so I had zero tolerance for misbehavior. I didn't threaten or make speeches on the subject. I just made the consequences very clear. In Bahrain, for example, my sailors hung out at the base bar and kept a close eye on the social temperature. The base security people said they could always tell Benfold sailors because they were the best behaved. One night, a serious fight resulting in casualties broke out between juiced-up sailors from two other ships. The Three Stars briefing reported that Benfold sailors refused to have anything to do with the rumble. As usual, they were clustered in a group on the far side of the bar, not getting involved. Maybe my crew's off-duty demeanor wasn't entirely voluntary, but we all liked the result. Whenever trouble broke out ashore, you could always rest assured that Benfold sailors would run from it, preserving the ship's well-earned reputation as a trustworthy ambassador. Freedom creates discipline. My interviews with the crew worked to empower my sailors to think and act on their own. But equally important, if not more so, was our follow-up process. In the interest of full disclosure and giving credit where credit is due, I will admit that I lifted this idea from the Army. Yes, the Army. Even a broken clock is right twice a day, and this idea was a keeper. It's called the After Action Review, or AAR. After every major decision, event, or maneuver, those involved gathered around my chair on the bridge wing and critiqued it. Even if things had gone well, we still analyzed them. Sometimes things go right by accident, and you are left with the dangerous illusion that it was your doing. We documented what we were trying to do, how we did it, what the conditions and variables were, and how we could improve the process in the future. The ground rules for these sessions were that you checked your ego at the door and that there was no retribution for any comments. I encouraged people to challenge or criticize anyone in the group. The most junior seaman could criticize the commanding officer. And they certainly took me up on that. One seaman told me, "Captain, your ship handling stunk today, and it made us do extra work." Horrors, you may say. Whatever happened to taut captains and tight ships? Bring back the cat-o'-nine-tails. But intrepid sailors win wars. Intimidated sailors lose them. Like most businesses in the Navy, there is no fat left on the bone. We no longer enjoy having extra people hanging around to take up slack. We have to get the mission accomplished with limited resources. The only way to do this is with a ruthlessly efficient organization. And if I was causing unnecessary work, then I wanted to know about it. If the crew had a problem with what I was doing, I wanted them to tell me so I could fix it or explain why I had to do things that way, thus expanding my crew's knowledge of limitations or requirements imposed on me. When people saw me opening myself to criticism, they opened themselves up. That's how we made dramatic improvements. People could get inside one another's minds. They could work together for the best possible Benfold. The result? We never made the same mistake twice, and everyone involved got to understand the big picture. To be honest, when I started my new leadership model, I was pretty anxious about its effect on military discipline. After all, when you let people out of prison, you have no idea how they will respond to their newfound freedom. I kept looking for clues. Was I really just creating anarchy? But quite the opposite happened. To my continued amazement, discipline actually improved under my regime. During my last 12 months in command, I had many fewer disciplinary cases than my predecessor. With one exception, I never fired or reassigned anyone. The exception was a sailor who'd been caught smoking marijuana before I arrived. When the results of his urinalysis arrived, I had no choice but to throw him out. The sentence was mandatory at the time. There was a corresponding dramatic drop in workmen's compensation cases, which can be an easy way for disgruntled sailors to be reassigned to a hospital. Safety-related mishaps almost disappeared. We went from 31 to only 2. When people feel they own an organization, they perform with greater care and devotion. They want to do things right the first time, and they don't have accidents by taking shortcuts for the sake of expedience. Previously, people were fighting to get off the ship. Now they were fighting to stay aboard. That kind of desire translates into performance. I am absolutely convinced that with good leadership, freedom does not weaken discipline, it strengthens it. Free people have a powerful incentive not to screw up. Chapter 6. Create a climate of trust. Once leaders have set the terms of the new social contract with their workers, they need to have the courage of their conviction. The best way to keep a ship, or any organization, on course for success is to give the troops all the responsibility they can handle and then stand back. Trust is a human marvel. It not only sustains the social contract, it's the growth hormone that turns green sailors into seasoned shipmates and troubled companies into dynamic competitors. But trust is a kind of jujitsu. You have to earn it, and you earn trust only by giving it. Here are the hard lessons I learned. Never pit dog against dog. When I took over Benfold, I found distrust throughout the ship. The competition to be named commander of a ship is fierce in the Navy, and the four department heads on Benfold were competing to get the highest rankings. In most ships, only the top two will ever get their own command. This adversarial relationship is built into the system, and it poisons the whole atmosphere. It divides the crew into factions, erodes their trust in one another, and reduces combat readiness. Growing up, I could never figure out why my commanding officers would tolerate this. For the life of me, I don't see why senior managers in business do so either. Internal bickering and posturing does nothing for the bottom line. One of the first things I did was to tell the four heads that their futures in the Navy depended on the overall success of Benfold. I said they had to believe that they would get bonus points from the selection boards if they worked together to turn Benfold into the best damn ship in the Navy. Together, we would sink or swim. It does no good to have the best weapons department in the Navy if the engineering department can't make the propellers turn and get us to the fight. All four have been screened for executive officer duties and are on track for ship commands as well. One of them, Lieutenant Commander John Wade of Long Island, New York, left Benfold and was immediately given command of a patrol craft, USS Firebolt. Firebolt had been run aground under the watch of John's predecessor. By using the Benfold playbook, John transformed Firebolt in a year from the worst of seven ships in its squadron to the best ship in the squadron. The ship was given the coveted Battle Efficiency Award for its crew's accomplishments. Another wonderful aspect of great leadership is that you leave a legacy, and your heirs, like John Wade, continue affecting others as they spread throughout the organization. As the department heads called off their war and focused on purpose, their people started trusting one another more and stopped questioning motives. People started communicating with one another. They helped one another if one department was having a rough time. There were no longer any silos. It was all being done for the collective good. Trust is like a bank account. You have got to keep making deposits if you want it to grow. On occasion, things will go wrong, and you will have to make a withdrawal. Meanwhile, it is sitting in the bank earning interest. When the entire organization wins, everyone in it wins. No one need be a loser. That construction is bogus. Even the worst screw-up may be redeemable. For career officers, the Navy policy is up or out. You can't stand still. Either you meet promotion standards or you're encouraged to leave. At first glance, this may sound like the right way to trim deadwood and build a strong officer corps, but great talent doesn't always fit the Navy mold. Sometimes the system builds conformity at the expense of competence, and late bloomers are often fired too early. The Navy can't afford those results. It is hard enough just to retain good officers who do fit the mold. Shortly before we left San Diego for the Persian Gulf, my commodore called me to report that our sister ship had fired one of its junior officers as an incompetent. The three-star admiral who ran San Diego told my commodore to find a home for this guy and see if he could be salvaged. We were in desperate need of officers because so many were getting out. The day before we deployed, Benfold received the officer on probation. His name was Elliot, and in short order, I discovered that he was among the most gifted naval officers I had ever met. He understood and could recite whole manuals and could explain complex procedures such as how to find enemy submarines. He knew more than some of my department heads, yet he was only 23 and barely out of the Naval Academy. Elliot had just one basic problem. He seemed to have little self-confidence, as a consequence of which he was a magnet for bullies. His previous shipmates had smelled blood and were unmerciful, ridiculing him routinely. The commanding officer didn't help the situation. In my book, nothing is sadder than people who try to inflate themselves by deflating others. The effects on Elliot, though not uncommon, were devastating. In response to being abused, he began to bark at others, perhaps to try to prove to himself that he had some control or power. I was very blunt with him. I told him that Benfold's crew lived and worked by the golden rule. We trusted that everyone would be treated with dignity and respect, and we expected no less for and from him. No one would belittle him, and of course, he must never ridicule others. And I authorized his chief petty officer to remind Elliot of this conversation if necessary. By helping him recognize his strengths, we wound up with a winner. Elliot turned out to be one of my best officers. Granted, he took a lot more of my personal time and required more nurturing than others, but my efforts were well invested. When it came to spotting and fighting submarines, for example, no one could match him. Moreover, he learned to take pleasure in helping others recognize their own strengths instead of the reverse. I was enormously pleased with his contributions and certainly happy to have him, but I was dismayed if not surprised that his previous ship had ignored his capabilities. Elliot eventually qualified as an officer of the deck, which retrieved his career. He went on to another tour in the Navy, then decided to go to business school. He left with his head high, a repaired record, and the confidence that comes from knowing how to lead people, a talent that will reward him enormously as he undertakes his leadership journey. My work with Elliot produced an unplanned, important benefit. He let me send a crucial signal to the rest of the crew. You may screw up, but we believe in comebacks. We will help and not give up on you. Leaders and managers need to understand that their employees are keenly attuned to their actions and reactions. If they see you give up on someone, they understand instantly that there's no room for redemption in this outfit, and they could be the next to go. If they see you intervene to help someone who is worth your effort, they will be reassured. Though the process is tedious and time-consuming, you will benefit if people feel more secure and are more willing to take risks and have a positive attitude about the organization. Guess who benefits most? You. Welcome the bad news messenger. It's critical that leaders don't shoot the messenger who brings bad news. A boss who does will not hear about future problems until they are out of hand. It isn't hyperbole to say that it can be a matter of life and death to create a climate of trust in which people are not afraid to deliver news that they know you don't want to hear. Benfold and other ships like her are incredibly complex structures packed with sophisticated technology, which is upgraded with every advance. Civilian engineers from the companies that built the machines, usually large defense contractors, complete the work. They install the equipment, then we live with the results. Aegis is the name of the missile fire control system on ships such as Benfold. In Greek mythology, Aegis was the shield made by Zeus from the head of the snake-headed Medusa. Today it means the shield of the fleet. Before we deployed from San Diego, Aegis engineers installed an upgrade that was supposed to make the system more reliable. In fact, it became less reliable as the numerous power modules within their radar started to short circuit. When such problems occur, the petty officers on the ship, who are assumed wrongly by the contractors not to know how to operate the new equipment, are the first to be blamed. Since Benfold was among the first ships to get the upgrade, and since we discovered the problem before anyone else, the engineers assumed that we were the problem. But we started tracking the other upgraded ships and soon learned that they were having the same trouble, but weren't telling anyone about it. I sent an urgent message to my Commodore in San Diego, telling him that the upgrade was reducing the ship's combat readiness. I had no idea how he would react because we had an odd relationship. When I took command, he had just left for a 6-week counter-narcotic operation in South America, so I was 6 weeks into my position before I met him. He called me in when he had to give me my first official fitness report. He rated me 6th out of 6, which didn't surprise me as I was the most junior of the 6. What I wasn't prepared for was that the only substantive thing he wrote was that I was qualified to keep my security clearance. It was a peculiar statement, but I was not upset, because I cared more about results and recognition, and I had confidence that results would soon materialize. I was relieved and delighted that the Commodore worked hard to alert everyone who needed to know about the Aegis problem. When I needed him to tear down barricades on my behalf, because our combat readiness was hindered, my boss was totally supportive. Aegis engineers were called in almost immediately. You should never bring petty problems to the attention of your boss if you can solve them yourself. But in critical situations like this one, I advise the opposite. Let him or her know as soon as possible. Bad news does not improve with age. The longer you wait, the less time your boss has to help you come up with a solution. The key is to establish your credibility by not being the manager who cries wolf. It was because I never complained about small problems that I was listened to when urgent matters came up. I also did my homework, so that when I presented the problem, I had all the facts to back up my claims. Having said that, let me add that a good boss is always a blessing. Soon after the Aegis incident, we had a more serious problem. Navy ships have to operate in any climate, from 130-degree heat in the Persian Gulf to below freezing in the North Atlantic. In low temperatures, fuel can jellify, so the ships are equipped with fuel oil service heaters to keep the fuel fluid. Even though Benfold had yet to operate in cold climates, we were required to keep these heaters operational just in case. We were in Singapore for 5 days of rest and relaxation when on a routine tour of the engineering plant, one of my sailors noticed fuel dripping from the fuel oil service heater onto a very hot piece of equipment. This was extremely dangerous. The dripping fuel could flash into a major fire that would destroy the entire engine room. We secured fuel throughout the ship and started to investigate. We discovered that the vibration of the ship moving through the water had caused the seals on the service heaters to crack. I sent messages to my Commodore and the Admiral immediately, reporting that we had narrowly averted a disaster because of a crewman's alertness. Fearing that this defect could be present on other ships with these same heaters, I recommended that every ship be checked. My Commodore wanted to support me, but this was a huge issue, and he wanted to make sure I knew what I was talking about. He sent a message to the commanding officer of a sister ship, which had the same heaters, and asked if he was having the same problem. The commanding officer, an engineer by training, tersely responded that I had vastly overreacted and that he didn't see the need to expend any resources to fix the problem. To his credit, the Commodore didn't accept that answer. He inspected other destroyers of the Arleigh Burke class that happened to be in port and found that some had the same leaks as Benfold, but no one had noticed them yet. Ironically, he even personally inspected our sister ship when she returned to port and found the same problem. He immediately informed a 3-star admiral, that all Arleigh Burke-class destroyers were at risk until the leaks were fixed. Benfold got kudos for calling attention to this potential disaster. As I have said, you never go wrong when you do the right thing. What gave me the courage to go out on that limb was that my Commodore had supported me on the Aegis problem. Since he had taken me seriously once, I trusted that he would again. I presented the sailor who discovered the leak with a Navy Achievement Medal right away. Though I should have gone through the bureaucracy for approval, I thought it was more important to make it clear that anyone performing a service for the ship would be recognized immediately. If you wait for the bureaucracy to act, people will forget why they're being recognized in the first place. This kid saved our ship, and I wanted to celebrate him while it was still fresh and made a difference. This brings up an important point. When do you break the rules? Bureaucracies can serve useful purposes. For example, a bureaucracy can slow down the implementation of a bad idea by giving the decision maker more time to reflect. However, more often than not, bureaucracies create rules and then forget why they were needed in the first place, or fail to see that the reasons for them no longer exist. When it comes to purging outdated regulations, bureaucracies are sclerotic. In today's fast-paced world, rules should be treated as guidelines, not as immutable laws, unless they are truly critical. If the rules weren't critical, I believe that my boss would want me to use my best judgment and do the right thing, regardless of the directive, because there are gray areas. The gray areas, in fact, are one reason we need mid-level managers. If everything were black and white, organizations would need only chief executives to make the rules and workers to carry them out without questions. Mid-level managers should be the ones to survey the gray areas and provide direction. When I interpreted the rules liberally, I was sure I would not be risking the company if I made an error. When I gave out more medals than I was authorized to do, I was simply using my best judgment to make the best use of the current situation. In the end, the bureaucracy never objected. And if they had objected, the Washington Post would have approved, since my decisions were benefiting my people, not me. Protect your people from lunatic bosses. Some bosses are heartless yet effective, and you have no choice but to endure them until they self-destruct or retire. Others, however, are much worse and should not be tolerated. They are autocrats who verge on lunacy. If power corrupts in civilian life, it can destroy in the military. This happens when someone in authority escapes being accountable and feels omnipotent, and it can endanger everyone. An officer or manager is duty-bound to protect his or her people from someone with this problem. I recognize fully that shielding your people from such a senior is excruciatingly painful and requires moral courage. But if the danger is clear and present, failure to act is moral cowardice. For me, the subject is not just academic. During one tour, I worked for two senior officers. One didn't seem to set up his crew for success, even though he ran a good ship, because his leadership style was to demean, and that kept us from being better. Though I wanted to tell him that his behavior was getting him nowhere, I didn't have the courage. The other officer ridiculed his officers and questioned their motives, which destroyed their initiative as well as the unity and purpose we had been working so hard to create. When it came time for me to stand up and defend these vulnerable officers, well, I stayed seated for fear of getting shot myself. I often look back on that as a squandered opportunity to lead, and am ashamed that I did not provide an asbestos firewall between the captain and his officers. This is one of the trickiest and most delicate situations a manager can be in. On the one hand, you must support the boss. Any company, just like the U.S. Navy, expects loyalty as a condition of employment. On the other hand, you must somehow help to minimize the damage that this behavior will do to the ship's well-being or the company's common interest. There is no easy solution. Eventually, I learned to manage that officer. I knew what triggered his rage, so whenever I had to deliver bad news, I did it privately, where his ranting and raving would not spew out on others, and I bore the brunt. When someone did exemplary work, I made sure he knew about it. When someone screwed up, I took responsibility for the error. I didn't always succeed in protecting my people. It was a painful time, and I'm not particularly proud of my actions. I could have done more for the junior officers, many of whom left the Navy. However, I did learn a lot about how to deal with impossible bosses. It is a critical skill. Being the best carries responsibility. The price of being the go-to ship is that you often get the toughest jobs, an honor that sometimes feels dubious. Benfold had become a key U.S. asset in the Middle East crisis. The Navy considered us so competent with Tomahawk cruise missiles that we were loaded with many more than any other ship. The downside was that we had to stay at sea continuously. Most ships stay out for 3 weeks at most and then come in for three-day breathers to relax, have a beer, call home. Not us. We had created so much trust in our reliability that we were victims of our own success. Much later, I heard from a friend in the Pentagon that when our 100 days in the Gulf were finally up, Secretary of Defense William Cohen himself was reported to have asked whether it was advisable to let us leave. He didn't mind rotating two aircraft carriers and a whole fleet of other ships, but Benfold, with its cruise missiles, was in a class by itself. During the height of the crisis, we spent 35 straight days at sea. Around day 25, we ran out of things to talk about at dinner. People just ate, got up, looked morose. The monotony left everyone dragging. I began feeling down myself, and when a leader is down, the whole organization takes the cue. I decided I had to buck us all up. I mustered the crew on the flight deck and said a few words. I know this has been a long haul out here, and that sailors on other ships have been enjoying liberties while you have been working. There's a reason. The Navy considers Benfold, and you people are Benfold, the most essential ship in the Gulf, the one that can't be spared. Quite simply, we are the best, and being the best carries with it responsibility. Thank you for hanging in there. Even I was surprised. The crew cheered. They accepted my explanation, and they were proud. Morale turned around dramatically. As I gauged the mood, about 60% of the crew were actually disappointed when we finally did pull into port. I grant that some of them were mindful that if you stay out 45 days, you get 2 free cans of beer, which at that point tastes like champagne, but I think pride was a more important motivation. That pride took an even greater strain a few weeks later, but it held again, and Benfold was rewarded for it. The big moment had finally arrived. We finished our 100th day in the Gulf and headed home. Not only had we done great work, we had also escaped any serious injuries or deaths. We hadn't fired any of our Tomahawks in anger, though we had spent several days awaiting launch orders to obliterate sites where Saddam Hussein was producing weapons. Each time when we got down to about 5 minutes from launch, we were told to hold. The UN Secretary General was again on the verge of negotiating a peace agreement. My crew was deeply disappointed that we did not get to shoot our missiles. There is nothing quite like the adrenaline rush that comes as these extraordinarily powerful weapons are launched. The whole ship shudders and shakes from the blast exhaust. Your heart beats faster as you watch on closed-circuit television as these million-dollar swords hurtle out of sight on the journey you made possible. All the hours of training and preparation to do what your country expects of you come together at that very moment. Honor and glory await you, probably even another medal for your chest. So it was absolutely devastating to have the missiles programmed and battery power applied to them and your finger on the button and then be told, never mind. The disappointment was palpable. People were demoralized. It was like when Lucy holds the football for Charlie Brown and then pulls it away at the last minute. Noticing the rapidly spreading dejection around the ship, I knew I had to act quickly or it would be tougher to rally them at the next crisis. They might even start to wonder why we bothered to keep our equipment and skills at peak performance levels if we weren't going to be allowed to use them. You have got to act quickly, I thought. I had no idea what to do. In desperate times, I always grabbed the microphone to communicate. Your people want to hear it from the top that everything is going to be all right after all. I got on the PA system and told them that I understood their disappointment. But we were on station and prepared. We had forced the Dom back to the bargaining table. So we actually succeeded in our mission. Due to the crew's professionalism, we had maintained peace. Guess what? The mood shifted back. My crew was back to brimming with pride and esprit de corps because they had done what they were supposed to do. In times of peril, people always turn to the guy at the top and look for guidance. In fact, one of the least understood aspects of our Navy is that, on any given day, more than 50% of our ships are at sea, whether on station maintaining this deterrent or preparing and sharpening our skills so that we will be ready when needed. As we all know, an agreement with Saddam never finalized. But our presence and readiness forced him to negotiate. Truth be told, I was secretly glad that we were not told to fire. For all their accuracy and reliability, those missiles could drift off course and kill innocent civilians, a possibility I found very sobering. At 7:55 in the morning of January 2, 1998, we weighed anchor off Bahrain for the voyage home. The whole crew was happily focused on our first scheduled stop, Australia, a country that welcomes American sailors perhaps more warmly than any other place on Earth. The fact that we had not been allowed to shoot was now a distant memory. Everyone was excited. I had even lined up fleet oilers to refuel us at sea so we could make the trip nonstop, a very unusual occurrence these days due to budget cutbacks. But no sooner had the anchor chain been secured than I got a call from the Commodore in charge of search and seizure operations in the Gulf, Commodore Mike Duffy. That Duffy was difficult was something upon which other commanding officers agreed. Yet, I came to understand him. He was extraordinarily demanding and held you accountable for your performance. Over the course of 100 days, he had come to love Benfold because we provided results. It was the ships that didn't that hated him. I knew right away Benfold was being drafted for yet another go-to job. Hold the shrimp, hold the Barbie, do not pass go, do not collect $200. At this point, I was actually wishing that we were not so good so we could rest. A ship smuggling contraband is headed down the Iranian coast, the Commodore said. I have run out of spare ships to track it. Can you take charge? Everyone on the Benfold Bridge heard the call because the radio speakers were turned on. They all looked at me. I believe the F word passed my lips. Some witnesses would later say that I said it multiple times. Out of deference to my mother, I need to let the record show that I did not learn that language at home. We had given at the office, and now we were being asked to give yet again. It wasn't fair, especially when you consider that the other two ships, Gary and Harry W. Hill, which together hadn't made a tenth of our contribution, were merrily on their way to Australia. Commodore, I said, Benfold is your ship. We will do it. My crew's heart sank. There was no joy in Mudville. This should take only 2 days, maybe less, the Commodore said. What speed will you need to make up the lost time getting to Australia? Our normal transit speed was 16 knots to save fuel. Only one engine was needed at that speed. Just off the top of my head, I said 24 knots, which would require two engines burning twice the fuel. I guarantee you will get extra fuel for your 24 knots. That assurance meant that the Commodore was going out on a limb to take care of us. At that moment, Mike Duffy was my hero. The crew cheered. I smiled. I knew that if I had put up any resistance, Duffy would not have given us the extra fuel. We put to sea and chased the smuggler down the Iranian coast. Soon a British warship joined us, but the rogue ship managed to skip into Dubai waters where we were banned from picking up smugglers. We could have stopped it by firing warning shots, but there were too many other fishing boats around, and I didn't want to risk killing innocent civilians. I asked the Commodore for a helicopter to help chase the smuggler, but the only one available was parked on the Gary, which initially declined to share it because the ship was en route to Australia. I thought it likely that the copter could have caught up with the ship after helping us, without significantly delaying the Gary. Commodore Duffy commandeered the aircraft by tersely ordering Gary's CO to lend it to us. I felt all the better for having taken on the chase mission without sniffling. No matter how reluctant I felt at the time, even though it was an ultimately unsuccessful mission. Helping your boss when he or she needs you badly is a pretty good investment. We finally set out across the Indian Ocean on January 3rd, only a day behind schedule, and checked into Fremantle in Western Australia on January 11th. Our orders called for 10 days of port visits in the wonderful land of Oz, but I guessed that no one would be checking our track. So I stepped on the gas between ports, and we squeezed out 12 days ashore. We wasted a few taxpayer dollars on excess fuel, but the return on investment in terms of crew morale more than covered the cost. Trust also makes money. Back in 1994, when I was second in command of Shiloh, some friends and I went out to eat at a restaurant on Coronado Island, across the bay from San Diego. As we sat at the bar waiting for our table, I struck up a conversation with an older gentleman by the name of Irv Refkin. It turned out that his wife of 47 years had just died, and he was very lonely. I invited him to join us for dinner. We have been good friends ever since. In 1997, when I was back in San Diego, getting ready to take command of Benfold, Irv and I went out to dinner once or twice a month. He owned a repair shop with about 75 employees. The company did repairs on Navy ships as well as some commercial work on pumps, motors, circuit breakers, and the like. It was a very successful specialty shop. I asked Irv what his business philosophy was. He said he preferred a handshake to a contract. He treasured his reputation, and he treated his employees with respect and dignity. He summed up, "Trust makes money." I asked for an example. "Time clocks," he answered. He described how he had installed time clocks for his employees back when they were all the rage. Then he had second thoughts. Didn't they imply a lack of trust? Out went the time clocks. As a result, his people not only worked full days without fail, but most worked longer than 8 hours. They felt trusted. Next, Irv moved on to tools. His general manager told him they needed a tool issue room to make sure employees did not steal the tools. So Irv hired a tool issue custodian for about $35,000 a year. He went down one morning and found a long line of employees waiting to check out tools. In the evening, there was another line to return them. This lack of trust was costing him money. So he did away with the tool issue room, reassigned the custodian to other work. And the following year, he had to spend only $2,000 for tools that were stolen or lost. Once again, trust was a moneymaker. His trust extended to customers as well, and it was reciprocated. If an admiral needed something repaired immediately, Irv dispensed with negotiations and contracts and got to work. His shop became the go-to shop on the waterfront when you wanted something fixed right the first time, at a good price, and without any hassle. My Irv Refkin story doesn't stop there. After taking command of Benfold, I invited him aboard for a tour. My sailors were loading food. It comes in big boxes and you form a human chain to pass them from the pier to the ship and down into the storage compartment. It is very hard work and people can be injured. This was the first time Irv had seen the operation. After 225 years in business, he said, "You'd think the Navy could figure out a better method." Irv went back to his shop and told one of his people to design a conveyor belt that could load the boxes automatically. A couple of weeks later, the prototype was finished. The bottom line? Irv now has a Navy contract to load stores on ships via a conveyor belt. He would have preferred a handshake agreement, of course, but they made him put it in writing. Navy trust hasn't caught up with Irv quite yet. Chapter 7. Look for results, not salutes. Like military services around the globe, the U.S. Navy is a hierarchy. Rank, seniority, and military discipline govern nearly everything. Officer country signs ban enlisted people from parts of nearly every ship. As gently as possible, I set out to chip away at this rigid system. Formal etiquette is never out of style in the Navy, nor was it on my ship. When I walked on deck, sailors cleared gangways, threw salutes, and stood at attention facing me, backs to bulkheads. They were honoring the office as sailors must. But in a short time, they learned that I was not interested in flattery or fluff. Rigidity gets in the way of creativity. Instead of salutes, I wanted results. which to me meant achieving combat readiness. The way to accomplish this was not to order it from the top, which is demoralizing and squashes initiative. I wanted sailors to open their minds, use their imaginations, and find better ways of doing everything. I wanted officers to understand that ideas and initiative could emerge from the lower deck, as well as muscle and blind obedience. And I wanted everyone on the ship to see one another as people and shipmates. As captain, I was charged with enforcing more than two centuries of accumulated Navy regulations, policies, and procedures. But every last one of those rules was up for negotiation whenever my people came up with a better way of doing things. As soon as one of their new ideas worked in practice, I passed it up the chain of command, hoping my superiors would share it with other ships. To facilitate that, I had to encourage the crew to take initiative and make sure the officers welcomed it. And that meant they would have to get to know one another as people. They would have to respect one another, and from that would come trust. Help knock down the barriers. On Sunday afternoons when the ship was at sea, we had cookouts on the aft flight deck, which was otherwise used for the anti-submarine helicopter. One Sunday early in my command, I went back to observe the cookout. A long line of sailors stood waiting to get their lunch. My officers would cut to the head of the line to get their food and then go up to the next deck to eat by themselves. The officers weren't bad people. They just didn't know any different. It's always been that way. When I saw this, I decided to go to the end of the line. The officers were looking down, curious. They elected the supply officer to come talk to me. "Captain," he said, looking worried, "you don't understand. You go to the head of the line." "That's okay," I said. "If we run out of food, I will be the one to go without." I stood in line and got my food. Then I stayed on the lower deck and ate with the sailors. The officers became totally alert. You could almost hear the gears shifting in their heads. The next weekend, we had another cookout, and without my saying anything to anyone, the officers went to the end of the line. When they got their lunch, they stayed on the lower level and mingled with the sailors. Given the Navy's basically classist society, to say that the fraternal scene on the flight deck was unusual would be an understatement. To me, it felt right. Within a month after taking command, I felt I was making progress in proving to my crew that I genuinely cared about them and would work with them to develop their potential. But the crew knew that a captain has to answer to those above in the chain of command. And I knew my sailors were waiting to see how I would act within the larger context of the Navy. Did innovation and empowerment end at Benfold's gangway? In mid-July 1997, I got a chance to show them. We were engaged in a week-long exercise to get ready for the Persian Gulf. Again, Benfold was traveling with Gary and Harry W. Hill. The senior officer in charge of this exercise, a Commodore embarked on Hill, was not particularly creative, but I considered him a nice guy and a solid officer. When the exercise started, I was down in the Combat Information Center, where the ship-to-ship radio blared continuous calls from the Commodore and other officers on Gary and Hill, and I soon realized that I was the only person answering. When I asked for an explanation, I was told that because so many people had previously been verbally chastised if they erred, no one would now take the initiative. This climate is actually very dangerous. In combat, you can have as many 10 radios needing attention and passing critical information at the same time, and obviously no one person can handle that. I authorized everyone to answer calls and make the necessary decisions, which surprised people who had never been given this level of responsibility. Halfway through the exercise, the Commodore flew over for a routine visit to see how things were going and gauge the morale of my crew. He flew in at 1100 hours, and we sat in my stateroom for a half hour. The plan was for him to stay for lunch, and at 1130 he headed for the officer's wardroom. "Commodore," I said, "that's not where we're having lunch." He looked at me quizzically and asked what I had in mind. I told him we were dining on the enlisted mess decks with my crew. His eyes grew wide. "I have not eaten a meal on the mess decks in years," he said. "Yes, sir," I said. "But I'd like you to meet my crew. Talk to my sailors. They might have questions for you." Crews complain when a senior officer or VIP is scheduled to come aboard and they're ordered to clean or even paint the ship in preparation, but have to be out of sight when the eminence arrives, as though they're not good enough to mingle with the brass. Well, on my ship, the VIPs were my crew, and I wanted the senior officers to spend time with them so they could discover how truly talented and dedicated they are. I wanted the brass to start developing the same respect for our people that I had. I escorted the Commodore to the mess decks and straight to the end of the line, where we stood waiting like everyone else. Of course, my sailor spoke to him respectfully, but as they had already learned with me, quite freely. They were having an ordinary conversation with an esteemed colleague. The Commodore had never had this experience before, and to his credit, he loved it. After we filled our trays, we found seats at two separate tables. Now, the Commodore was on his own with seven sailors. They asked good questions. He listened intently and answered directly. I could see from my own table that everyone was interested, involved, smiling, and having fun, which for me was both gratifying and something of a relief. If the Commodore had been a traditional martinet, the experiment could easily have been a fiasco. Instead, he was impressed by the caliber of my crew's questions. He had had no idea that lesser ranks could teach him anything. But when one petty officer asked him what he thought about the Navy's leadership continuum, a new training program for enlisted people, the Commodore was caught short. He knew nothing about it. Since the program affected only enlisted people, not officers, he had seen no reason to pay attention to it. Now, he realized with a shock, that he was totally ignorant about a program of vital importance to 1,500 sailors aboard the six ships under his command. Another boss might have been resentful at being shown up, but again, I had gauged him right. When we left the mess decks and returned to my cabin, he said this had been the most worthwhile experience he'd ever had in the Navy. From now on, he planned to have lunch on the mess decks of whatever ship he visited. To my knowledge, he has kept that promise and as a result has stayed in close touch with what crews think, need, and want. From that incident forward, I resolved that VIPs would always eat with my crew. And if the VIP wasn't around at mealtime, I would make sure that he or she had other opportunities to interact with the crew. I started eating at least one meal per week on the mess decks with the crew. It paid big dividends. I learned a great deal and got to know people that way. And after a while, my officers began taking occasional meals there too. I usually went to the noon meal on Wednesdays, and it's a Navy tradition that lunch on Wednesday is always cheeseburgers. The Navy term for them is sliders, in tribute to the grease. Well, my senior enlisted advisor, Command Master Chief Bob Sheeler of Laramie, Wyoming, was a huge parrot head, a fan of the singer Jimmy Buffett. So every Wednesday at precisely 11:30, we would play Buffett's Cheeseburger in Paradise over the public address system. It was cool at first, then everyone got sick of it, except Bob. He continued to play it. We finally got so sick of it that it became cool again. But on the last Wednesday of our deployment to the Persian Gulf, I decided that song would play no more on my ship. So we had a raffle for charity. A $1 contribution bought you a chance to shoot the CD with a shotgun. We raised over $1,000 for charity and never again played that song, until my last Wednesday in command of Benfold. As a result of his tour on Benfold, Master Chief Sheeler is an icon in the enlisted ranks. Sailors and Master Chief Petty Officers alike want to know how he blossomed as a genuine leader during the time we worked together. I recently asked him what he tells other Command Master Chiefs when they asked what made the biggest difference for him as a leader, and his response amazed me. I had completely forgotten the incident that he never will. The position of Command Master Chief has the potential to be either the best job in the Navy or the worst. It entails representing the interest of the enlisted population to the upper ranks on the ship. Master Chief Sheeler often told me that he previously had felt like his views were ignored. I felt his views deserved attention. Our meetings on the ship were usually held in the officers' mess, which had seats for only 15 people. More than that attended, so many stood. It was standing room only at my first meeting after taking command. I had a reserve seat, as did my XO, I took a look around the room and saw that Master Chief Sheeler was standing 3 deep in the back of the room. Without clearly thinking through the ramifications of what I was about to say, I announced that from then on, the Command Master Chief of USS Benfold, like the CO and XO, would have a reserved seat. His would be to my immediate left, and the XO would be to my right. The department head who had to vacate the seat flashed a look indicating that he was clearly perturbed. But, as I intended, the enlisted crew realized that Master Chief Sheeler now had prominence, and that the needs of the entire crew would be taken into consideration. Master Chief Sheeler was now going to play a critical role in charting the course on Benfold. Sometimes, all you need is a seat at the table. From that day forward, Sheeler never let me or his people down. He has become a sought-after sage for his knowledge about leadership. The Arleigh Burke class of destroyers, which includes Benfold, is named after a World War II Commodore who won the Battle of Cape St. George with a squadron that was undermanned and outgunned by the Japanese. Admiral Arleigh Burke, a certified naval hero, went on to become Chief of Naval Operations, and he commissioned a painting of his ships going into the battle. It was a splendid picture. Shortly before his death at age 98, he gave the first of 750 prints of it to Defense Secretary Perry. One day I came home from sea to find a huge package on my front porch. It was the painting. Perry had sent it to me. I think Perry had seen my face when I first saw that painting. It would have looked wonderful on my stateroom wall where I could have enjoyed it every day, but I wanted the crew to be reminded at every meal of the ship's history and tradition stretching all the way back to World War II. So I had it displayed on the mess decks, and I think they really appreciated it. Let your crew feel free to speak up. I was determined to create a culture where everyone on board felt comfortable enough to say to me, "Captain, have you thought of this?" Or, "Captain, I'm worried about something." Or even, "Captain, I think you're dead wrong and here's why." Yes, people are a cancer in any organization and dangerous to boot. Throughout my career, I have watched people at the top actively discourage lower ranks from speaking up and contributing all that they can. On one ship I served in, we got a new executive officer. He was very talented. We would have felt comfortable going to war under his command. But his major flaw was you could not tell him anything. He knew it all, period. We were at sea one morning at 0530, before Reveille had sounded, when he hit the deck running and ordered a man overboard drill. That's a crucial test of the crew's readiness to save a downed pilot, help another vessel in distress, or rescue a crew member in heavy weather. It requires precise seamanship by everyone from the officer of the deck to the coxswain guiding the small boat that will pick up the man overboard. It's a great exercise when done properly, and it boosts morale, not only by helping everyone improve his or her skills, but also by reassuring sailors that if they were washed into the sea, their buddies could save them. The XO was so gung-ho that he chose to sound the alarm before Reveille and wake everyone from a deep sleep. There was nothing wrong with that, because this was just an exercise in safe waters off the coast of California. Had we been part of a carrier battle group in an actual search for submarines, we would have been towing decoys astern on a cable about 600 feet long. In that situation, if any enemy sub fired a torpedo at the ship, you can activate noisemakers on the decoys that fool the torpedo into heading for them instead of your ship. The problem was that those decoys made it impossible to change course more than 180 degrees at one time, because the propellers would run over the cables and cut them. Man overboard drills require a tight, full circle to get the ship back to its original position in the line. Clearly, something had to give. I was standing watch in the ship's combat information center, and as soon as I heard that the drill had been launched, I asked the XO to give me 15 minutes to reel in the decoys. But he wanted to proceed with the exercise without delay. The next thing I knew, a floating dummy was tossed overboard. The whistle sounded 6 short blasts to signal a man overboard. All 4 engines accelerated to 30 knots, and the ship turned sharply, heading straight for the decoys. I got on the PA system and warned the XO 3 times about the cables. "Reel them in. Reel them in. I'm proceeding with this exercise," he shouted. but I couldn't reel them in less than 15 minutes. The drill was going to be over in 4. The third time I tried to warn them, the XO called back, "Don't tell me again. I know they're out there. Reel them in." The operation was a spectacular success, but the patient died. The severed decoy cables cost the taxpayers some $50,000. Moreover, it took almost 3 months to replace the cables, during which time, had we been attacked by torpedoes, we could not have distracted them as effectively. In short, we could have coordinated better with each other. I wish I could say that the need to improve listening skills and less than perfect coordination happened only in the past. But the tragic sinking of a Japanese fishing boat off Honolulu by the submarine USS Greenville suggests otherwise. The moment I heard about it, I was reminded that, as is often the case with accidents, someone senses possible danger but doesn't necessarily speak up. As the Greenville investigation unfolded, I read in a New York Times article that the submarine's crew respected the commanding officer too much to question his judgment. If that's respect, then I want none of it. You need to have people in your organization that can tap you on your shoulder and say, "Is this the best way?" Or, "Slow down." Or, "Think about this." Or, "Is what we are doing worth killing or injuring somebody?" History records countless incidents in which ship captains or organization managers permitted a climate of intimidation to pervade the workplace, silencing subordinates whose warnings could have prevented disaster. Even when the reluctance to speak up stems from admiration for the commanding officer's skill and experience, a climate to question decisions must be created in order to foster double-checking. Make your people feel they can speak freely, no matter what they want to say. If they see that the captain wears no clothes, let them say so. Facts are facts and deserve attention, not retribution. Yes, I'm pushing you to work harder at leading your organization. Yes, the climate I prescribe is tough to create. But in my view, had someone been comfortable tapping that commanding officer and saying, "Sticking to a schedule isn't important enough to justify taking safety shortcuts," that accident on Greenville might have been avoided. How they all must wish they had that day to live over. When leaders and managers behave as though they are above their people, when they announce decisions after little or no consultation, when they make it clear that their orders aren't to be questioned, then conditions are ripe for disaster. The good news is that every leader has the power to prevent this. Once leadership opportunities are squandered, you can never get them back. Don't live your life with regrets. Free your crew from top-down-itis. The fall of 1997 was a heady time aboard Benfold. The ship was improving and morale was soaring. Still, I was determined to turn the ship into an institution of continual learning, which entailed a systematic and methodical analysis of what worked and what didn't. At first, my ambition seemed quixotic. I remember sitting in my captain's chair on the bridge, watching some sailors screw up a simple operation on the deck below, gripping the chair arms until my knuckles turned white. My sailors were painting some fittings on the fire station's bright red. The only problem was they weren't using a drop cloth, and red paint was dripping all over the gray deck that they had painted only a week before. Now they would have to go back and repaint the deck gray. What was wrong with those people? Why couldn't they see that they were creating more work for themselves? But instead of flaring up like Captain Bly, threatening to draw and quarter every dummy who disgraced my ship, I bit my tongue. The incident induced a memory from my childhood. Every summer I had to paint the trim, on our brick house 1 year, the garage the next. One time, I too failed to use a drop cloth and dripped white paint on the red brick. My mother tore a huge chunk from my behind. She hadn't yet learned the art of grassroots leadership either, which taught me the lesson, but left me mad and resentful. So I explained to my sailors how using a drop cloth would directly benefit their free time, and they got the message. And slowly as they warmed to the new approach, the crew began to take responsibility for their mistakes. I wanted them to own Benfold, to feel that it was their ship, and to turn it into the fittest ship in the Pacific Fleet. Of course, I treated people with the same dignity and respect I expected from them. And I made sure they truly liked their jobs. Freed from top-down-itis, Benfold sailors were given responsibilities to make decisions, correct mistakes, and prove to themselves that they were part of a superb crew. I anticipated some short-term problems. I knew our performance could dip a bit as people were learning and growing comfortable with